Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My next guest is a researcher and the director of the Moore Center for the Prevention of Child Sexual Abuse at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The center is holding a virtual symposium that begins tomorrow to discuss ways to stop the abuse of children. There's data to suggest that abuse has, in fact, increased during the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Elizabeth Letourneau joins me on Zoom. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome back.
Hi, Tom. I'm so glad to be here with you today.
So talk about the data. What do we know about what's happened in terms of child sexual abuse during the COVID-19 pandemic?
Sure. We know a little bit and we suspect a little bit. So let me be clear about that. There's two aspects of the pandemic responses that may have actually reduced some types of child sexual abuse. And there's two aspects of the pandemic responses that may have increased some types of child sexual abuse. So first of all, of course, most children, including my own, were kept home from school and other activities. This quarantining aspect of the pandemic likely reduced incidents of child sexual abuse perpetrated by people outside the home as a result, of course, of having less access to the kids. This would include people like coaches, teachers, religious, neighbors, camp counselors, peers, and so on. Another way that pandemic responses might have reduced child sexual abuse incidents is through more consistent parental supervision. So, of course, many parents, myself included, were kept home from work and other activities. And so this increased more consistent parental supervision, as I mentioned, may have reduced incidents of child sexual abuse perpetrated by people outside or even inside the home. We don't yet have data to assess whether these reductions occurred, or at least we haven't analyzed these data yet. However, work that I and my colleagues did several years ago showed that child sexual abuse declines during holidays and festivals. For example, on Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, these are days with very low rates of child sexual abuse in the United States. And we believe this is because kids are typically with their parents on these days and they benefit from more parental supervision. Now that said, some parents do sexually abuse their children or are at risk of doing so, and children in these families might be at increased risk of abuse during quarantine. And this is where we do have some data. My colleagues and I recently analyzed service use metrics, so things like web page views, from two organizations that provide confidential helplines and self-help resource pages around child sexual abuse. The two organizations are Stop It Now USA and the Lucy Faithful Foundation in the United Kingdom. And what we found were increases in self-help page views in 2020 relative to 2019. And in particular, the self-help pages with the largest increases had titles including, I'm Worried About My Own Sexual Thoughts and Behaviors, and I Need Help With My Sexual Thoughts About a Stepdaughter, and also Why Permission From a Child or an Underage Teen Doesn't Count. So these were people going to look for help and for resources because they had concerns about their own sexual thoughts and sexual behaviors when it came to children. We also found an increase in helpline inquiries. These are helplines where you could call in or email for help. And while there's helplines for parents and for partners of people who might be engaging in harmful sexual behavior, there's also helplines for people concerned about their own sexual thoughts or behaviors. And that's where we saw the largest spikes, like an 82% increase in people reaching out with concerns about their own sexual thoughts and behaviors.
82%. Wow, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. You study in this symposium that you're going to be sponsoring tomorrow and the next day. It looks at ways to prevent children from being abused. Obviously, there's no one size fits all that's going to work in every case. But what is the data showing about, you know, some of the interventions that are effective?
Well, we we do not have a whole lot of data on child sexual abuse prevention interventions, because until recently, there really has not been any money to study that. We in the US and elsewhere really come at child sexual abuse after the facts. We put a lot of resources into criminal justice interventions like detecting, prosecuting, incarcerating sex offenders. By comparison, we put very little resources into preventing child sexual abuse from happening in the first place. So at the Moore Center, we've been able to create a couple of prevention programs that really target the perpetration of child sexual abuse. For example, one which is an online intervention for people with sexual attraction to children who don't want to act on that attraction. We are just in the process, we got funding last year from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention to evaluate that intervention as part of a randomized controlled trial. So that'll be as far as I know, one of the first really rigorous evaluations of a perpetration prevention intervention in the US. We do know that for that online intervention, which is called Help Wanted, we've actually had over 180,000 people visit that website since it was launched last May, about a year ago. So that's a lot of people interested in looking for help for sexual interest in children. And so we think that this is reaching a lot of people. What we need to know is if it actually reduces the likelihood that they'll act on that attraction.
And when it comes to that, if a person presents either in person or anonymously on one of these websites, then is the approach, if a person says, I have a sexual attraction to children, what can I do to not act on it? Is the approach to say, look, don't have that attraction. That's the wrong attraction to have. Or is the approach to say, well, if that attraction is a fact of your life, then we've got to figure out ways to make sure that you never do anything with that attraction because that is so devastating and harmful to children. How do you look at it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've spoken with dozens, maybe at this point, hundreds of people with a sexual attraction to children who view it as an unwanted affliction. If there was a way to get rid of it, and I laughed a little when you said that, if there was a way to get rid of this attraction, they would have figured that out. So it's not that sexual attractions don't change. They can certainly change over time. We know that for everybody. But these attractions to, for example, prepubescent children seem to be pretty stable. And so there's two components of what I believe will prove to be effective prevention programming. One is providing people with sexual attraction to children the tools and the knowledge and the skills to avoid acting on that. You know, what do I do when I'm when I find myself attracted to a child? How do I get away from that? How do I avoid acting that? How do I find sexual satisfaction with adults if I'm not attracted to children? Is there a way to do that? The other component of effective interventions for people with unwanted sexual attraction to children is to also just support their general mental and physical health and well-being. We know that people, when we are physically and mentally healthy, which we've all struggled with, I would say, during the pandemic, we are better able to act in our own best interest and in the best interests of those around us. And so it isn't only about addressing the risk to offend. Many of these individuals have figured out how not to act on that attraction. What they really need is, how do I live with having this attraction, which is possibly the most stigmatized personal characteristic a person can have on the planet. And so we address both of those needs with our Help Wanted intervention, and some other interventions that are available starting to pop up around the world are also taking this two-pronged approach.
I'm interested to learn from you that among the people who are perpetrators of abusing young children are kids themselves, 12, 13-year-olds. Why is it that these children are abusing even younger children? What is your research, exposing about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Kids are just learning to be sexual when they're, you know, 11, 12, 13, 14 years of age, and they don't know the rules. You know, sex is complicated. Sexual behaviors are complicated. Concepts like consent are complicated, even for many adults. And we're not very good about teaching them the rules and the social mores. We think kids sort of automatically know when they are becoming sexual that younger kids are off limits, and kids absolutely do not know that. So our other prevention program that we've developed and tested is targets younger kids, 6th and 7th grade children, with really clear information on why we don't involve younger children, why they shouldn't involve younger children in sexual behavior as they're beginning to explore.
Dr. Elizabeth Letourneau is a professor in the Department of Mental Health and the director of the Moore Center for the Prevention of Child Sexual Abuse at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. In our last 20 seconds, Elizabeth, tell us what this symposium is going to be about.
Well, it's all about how we collaborate together to keep children safe. And so there's more on how we can prevent child sexual abuse at the symposium. And I think on WYPR, there's a link where people can register for free for this symposium, and also a link to our Moore Center website where people can find help both for parents and for help seekers looking for resources around child sexual abuse prevention.
Yep, and you're right. We will have that link to the symposium and more on the Moore Center at WIPR.org/midday. Elizabeth, thank you so much for your time and for your work. It's an important and difficult, complicated thing, and I'm glad you're thinking about it and have been thinking about it for a long time. Appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow, a conversation about an influential religious and civil rights leader, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. The Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch and Benjamin Sachs, a scholar at the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies, will join me to talk about Heschel's influence and legacy. There's a new film about Abraham Joshua Heschel that'll air on public television next month. As well, Dr. Letitia Geraza, the Baltimore City Health Commissioner, will join us with a COVID-19 update. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.